Grid Lords by Tom Rath.
More episodes are already waiting at patreon.com/TomRath.
The voice you are hearing is generated by AI. Chapter 10. Nicholas stood at the gates of the town, his chest swelling with pride as he looked upon the 3rd Division lined up in their finest splendor. The swords and spears of the infantry glistened in the sun, while the musket troopers held their polished weapons. The auto riflemen stood a little further back, their guns oiled and gleaming, anticipation written clearly on their faces. Beside Nicholas stood Brian, his eyes also bright with pride. He too admired their well-prepared soldiers, with a particular fondness for the small but elite group positioned at the front of the ranks, directly behind himself and Nicholas. These were the highly skilled commandos, a handful of soldiers trained and equipped for all conditions. They bore swords, flint pistols, and submachine guns, weapons that embodied the deadly blend of power and agility required for their unique fighting style. The commandos stood tall and proud, their faces displaying a quiet confidence and determination that spoke volumes. As the entire division stood in attention, they awaited the arrival of the emissary from the Boston Empire. Their faces displayed a mix of trepidation and curiosity mixed with excitement, for it was not common for these great overlords to visit. The soldiers squinted into the distance, trying to discern any signs of the shrouded company from the Empire approaching. Suddenly, they saw it, a group of figures speeding across the land, faster than any galloping horse, propelled by the unseen power of the footfield beneath them. Most likely dispatched from the Boston Empire's vassal state of Chicago, the traveling group was an imposing sight. The soldiers could see the glint of armor and the fluttering of banners, but the full details remained obscured. Nonetheless, they stood firm and prepared to welcome these enigmatic travelers to their town. As the company drew nearer and nearer, the hum of the footfield grew louder, creating a palpable sense of anticipation among the onlookers. The soldiers, eager to know more about the newcomers, traded whispered theories and guesses about the gridlord who was likely driving the field. They knew that it wouldn't be long until the emissaries arrived and the shroud was lifted, revealing not only the colors and sigils of the company, but also the identity of the powerful figure controlling the footfield that drove them forward. With each passing moment, the energy of the waiting soldiers grew, manifesting in tightly weapons and wary, expectant expressions. Standing between the 3rd Division and the approaching contingent were the resplendent figures of Brightforge and Arkstone, two mighty warriors clad in their awe-inspiring power armor painted in vibrant shades of orange and black. The shimmering energy of their armor seemed to emit a powerful aura, a testament to their status as pillars of Cincinnati's power and prowess. Brightforge cut an imposing figure. His tall frame was covered in the ornate power armor, and on his back rested the menacing grip of his glowing sword. Anyone who gazed upon him would immediately recognize a champion, a seasoned warrior whose strength and courage had earned him the deep respect and admiration of his people. Beside him, Arkstone was gargantuan, the unwavering guardian of the city. With a monstrous, blazing shield in hand, his presence alone was enough to instill confidence in those under his protection. Apart from this magnificent shield, Arkstone also carried a short hand axe at his waist. Together, these two formidable warriors were a perfect embodiment of Cincinnati's force and determination. Within the varied cities of the land, each held its own unique system of governance. In Cincinnati, the sword, represented by the imposing figure of Brightforge, was always considered the leader of the city. Upon his selection as sword, Brightforge was also elected as the premier of Cincinnati, elevating him to a position of great prominence and responsibility. As they waited for the arrival of the emissaries, Brightforge and Arkstone emanated an air of strength and confidence that reverberated through the waiting ranks of the 3rd Division. The Empire Party suddenly slowed down about 500 yards away, and as the footfield dissipated, they continued their approach at a more normal pace. Nicholas watched them intently, observing the details of their delegation. At the forefront, he could see the Empire diplomat, adorned in blue, red, and white robes, the unmistakable colors of the Empire. Assisting the diplomat were several aides, dressed in similar garb. Behind them marched an impressive array of elite Empire commandos and knights, each one wielding a rare and awe-inspiring glowing power weapon. Their assortment of axes, swords, and spears spoke to their versatile and potent fighting skills, to the wealth the Empire has amassed over decades of dominance, Uta the Emperor and the Blood Knight. A short distance away from the main party and standing apart, the figure of a Gridlord became clear. The navy armor with orange trims was a telltale sign of their origin from Chicago. Holding a huge glowing axe, the imposing Gridlord was none other than Tyrannus Edgecutter. Nicholas was immediately impressed. Edgecutter had an impressive reputation despite the waning talent of the Empire. It was clear that the presence of one of their best Gridlords, alongside the finely tuned skills and display of weaponry by the Empire knights and commandos, was designed to demonstrate a show of force and determination by the Empire. As the party continued its approach, it was a powerful reminder of the might that backed these envoys from the Boston Empire. Delegations between cities traditionally avoided meeting in the tower, as it was deemed too risky due to the potential for subterfuge, especially among less friendly city-states. However, cities under the Empire were expected to receive Empire delegations within their tower as a mark of submission and trust. When the two parties finally met, Nicholas spotted the Empire diplomat approaching Brightforge. It was none other than the governor of Chicago, Cassian Ashford. Ashford was known for his haughty and disrespectful demeanor, and it was clear that he expected to gain entry to the tower without hesitation. Cassian Ashford began to speak, addressing the gathered assembly with elaborate greetings on behalf of the Empire. On this auspicious day, I bring felicitations and warm regards from His Imperial Majesty, the Emperor, the glorious crown of the Northeast, and the protector of our realm. May his reign be ever prosperous and enduring, Ashford said, listing off the many honorifics and titles associated with the Emperor. Brightforge, however, responded with a curt greeting. Thank you, Governor Ashford. Welcome to Cincinnati. Arkstone couldn't resist adding, in a humorous tone, Howdy to you all, too. Ashford, visibly perturbed but maintaining his composure, continued, Certainly, it is kind of you to greet us at the gates. However, it is time we proceed into the tower to discuss our business. Brightforge stood firm, replying, We appreciate your enthusiasm, but we shall stay here to discuss matters. Trying his best to hide his annoyance, Ashford conceded, Very well. It is indeed a fine day. One spends so much time cooped up in towers. It might be nice to enjoy some time in the fresh air. We shall have our meeting here. With a snap of his fingers, Ashford gave a signal, and a table, chairs, and a light lunch emerged from the crowd of warriors behind him. They were carried by attentive assistants, who efficiently arranged the items for the meeting. Nicholas took note of the fact that in times past, refusing entry to the tower like this would have resulted in war or severe punishments. He reasoned that Ashford must be aware of the Empire's waning hold on Cincinnati, and was likely apprehensive about their ability to suppress the city's growing martial forces, backed by their powerful Gridlords. Brightforge accepted a chair and gracefully seated himself, removing his helmet to reveal a handsome, cocky face that reflected his formidable reputation. He casually picked at the grapes provided to him. Arkstone, however, chose to remain standing, his vigilant eyes never leaving the visitors from the Empire. Silence settled over the gathering, and the atmosphere grew tense as Brightforge and Arkstone allowed the silence to continue, giving the Empire envoys the opportunity to introduce the purpose of their meeting. Eventually, Ashford broke the silence, saying, We have come to understand that Cincinnati has recently captured a wild orb. Strangely enough, the Empire was not informed of this achievement, nor have we received the 50 flows in tithe that is owed to us as per the agreement of vassalage. Brightforge responded firmly, As we have told the Empire before, we no longer accept its dominion. Arkstone couldn't help but chuckle at the exchange. Ashford, seeming unfazed, leaned in. It is not uncommon for vassal cities to make such bold declarations, he said, often without truly considering the consequences. This may be the first actual act of defiance we have seen from Cincinnati, withholding flows that are the Emperor's by law, by your city's own commitments, but I'm confident that you do not genuinely mean to challenge the supremacy of the Empire. Brightforge spoke calmly in response. We stand by our words. The orb is ours, the flows are ours, and more importantly, this city is for the people of Cincinnati, not the Empire. Arkstone concurred, though with a gleeful mix of humor and profanity. That's right. The people of Cincinnati ain't bowing to the Empire's whims anymore. Throughout the discussion, Tyrannus Edgecutter eyed the duo with an air of aloof disinterest. Nicholas could clearly jug that Edgecutter would be outmatched by both Brightforge and Arkstone, not to mention the watchful presence of the Scepter, who was undoubtedly observing the proceedings from the nearby tower. Ashford, leaning in even closer, spoke in a low, urgent voice. This is madness. Consider the facts. You have fine gridlords here in Cincinnati, and your army is impressive, yet both are dwarfed by the Emperor's forces, which command dozens of gridlords. Cincinnati would be devoured in a conflict. You must not let pride blind you. Think of your people and the long history your city has as part of the Empire. Brightforge responded in a hushed tone. There are whispers that the New York kingdoms are ready to break away from the Empire. Their departure would mean 10 fewer suits for the Empire, and the opening of a second front. The Empire has been preoccupied with keeping those inner territories in check. Ashford retorted, Should Cincinnati set such a precedent, you would face the full might of the Empire. We would make an example of this rebellion to discourage others. As for New York, the people there are utterly loyal. They love the Emperor, whereas the two kings of New York are loathed by the population. Don't be misled by idle whispers. Brightforge couldn't help but interject with an eloquent and humorous diversion. Well, if loyalty in New York is unshakable, perhaps the Empire can focus its efforts on improving its own cities, no? Arkstone followed up, adding a cruder repetition of the sentiment. Yeah, y'all should remember that charity begins at home, don't you think? Ashford's face paled slightly, realizing the difficulty in convincing the defiant leaders to give in. He shifted tactics and offered a revised vassal agreement. Considering that Cincinnati captured a wild orb and did all the work, perhaps the Empire could accept a lesser tribute for the time being. Let us say 40 flows? But Brightforge didn't budge. Instead, he responded with a veiled barb. Or perhaps the Emperor could use a single flow to help the needy and hungry in the crumbling cities of the Empire. I think the people of Cincinnati would understand if we made a donation like that, considering the plight of the poor in the glorious Empire. Arkstone chimed in. Ain't no shortage of needy folks there, Governor. Ashford's anger grew with each retort. The Empire has raised countless people out of poverty. By managing the grid, providing law and order, and creating an era of unprecedented peace, we have achieved a stable and prosperous society. Arkstone shot back. By robbing people of their freedom, you mean... Brightforge added, Please, Governor, peace at the edge of a sword is not real peace. At this, Ashford stood up, his face red with rage. If you refuse to accept peace at the edge of a sword, then prepare to feel the edge itself. Your failure to pay the flows means war, Brightforge. We will not tolerate such insubordination. Chapter 11. Over the next few days, Clive found himself slowly adjusting to his new reality. The conversations with Jarway were long and filled with information about the world he now inhabited. As unbelievable as it all was, the impossibility of his situation was starting to lose its initial shock. During his time in this new world, Clive had grown quite fond of Erilyn. She was an attractive young woman with an enchanting presence that made it hard to resist spending time with her. It wasn't just her beauty that drew Clive to her. She had an incredible warmth and genuine kindness that made it easy to imagine feeling at home in this strange time. Clive was still consumed, thinking of his life back in the 21st century and the people he had left behind. His heart ached at the thought of his friends and family who would now be long dead. In some ways, he was grateful that he had been a single man with no wife or children to mourn their loss. The heartache would have been almost unbearable. As the days burned up and time sped forward, Clive began to accept his new life more fully. He still had moments of disbelief and sadness, but they were growing fewer and farther between. The people of this strange, technological, and seemingly magical world were warm and welcoming, and Clive found solace in their company. Clive sat in the garden, waiting. The plants and flowers around him seemed both familiar and alien, much like everything else in this strange world. He couldn't help but feel a mixture of excitement and nerves at the prospect of meeting a Gridlord. Jarway believed that Clive's past knowledge might shed some light on the mysteries of the Grid, and perhaps even be of benefit to the city. Of course, Jarway had also warned Clive that the power dynamics between the city leaders and the priests could be delicate. The priests protected their knowledge fiercely, and any perceived interference from an outsider could lead to dangerous tensions. It was essential that Clive tread carefully. That was why he was waiting to meet Keelan Hearthguard, Denver's Arrow, and younger brother of the captain of the Tower Guard. Keelan was sheathed in the armor of a Gridlord, and this meeting could provide a discreet opportunity for Clive to test his understanding of the technology. It was also hoped that by aligning himself with someone well-respected and established within the city hierarchy, Clive could gain acceptance and build trust. Finally, Keelan arrived, striding down the garden path with an air of confidence and disconnection, helmeted head lingering on the beautiful topiaries. He was an impressive figure, tall and well-built. As Keelan approached, Clive couldn't help but marvel at the impressive sight before him. The armored figure wore a suit of orange with navy trim, and glowing lights adorned various points on the armor, creating an awe-inspiring aura. There was no hiss of actuators, only a gentle hum that suggested great power contained within. The armor was sleek and form-fitting in some places, while in others it fanned out into larger shoulder guards and plates. Keelan's voice came through the visor, light-hearted and apologetic. "I'm so sorry for my tardiness. I hope I haven't kept you waiting too long." Caught off guard by the humble tone, Clive replied, "Oh, it's no problem at all. I didn't have anything pressing to do." As he spoke, Keelan reached for his helmet, which seemed to deform slightly as he removed it. With a sincere expression on his face, he insisted once more, "I truly apologize. You are someone very special, sent by the Prophet, and everyone has been talking about it. With all the time Jarway has been spending with you, I should have been more punctual." Clive assured him, "Please, think no more of it." Keelan smiled, almost shyly. "Elder Jarway told me to come to you that you might have an opportunity to inspect my armor, to see if your arcane wisdom might be applied to its understanding. Please understand that while I am willing, I might be a little uncomfortable. It is strange and unusual to let another interact with a Gridlord's armor, save for priests and pods. You might say this is a little intimate for my liking, but I don't grudge you the opportunity." "Curious?" Clive asked. "Pods?" Keelan seemed surprised. "Yes, the structures in the tower where we go to heal our suits when they're damaged or we're tired. Jarway said you knew very little, but I didn't realize how little given your supposed wisdom." Clive confessed, "My knowledge is based on progenitor tech. I'm not familiar with what exists today. Jarway wants to see if I can apply that knowledge to what is used now." Keelan, awestruck, replied, "Progenitor tech? You mean what came before the suits, before the Oracle?" Clive felt the urge to ask about the Oracle, but he decided not to derail the current conversation. The opportunity to get up close with the armor was too compelling. As Clive began to carefully examine Keelan's armor, he couldn't help but be amazed by the intricacies and advanced technology that allowed for such a seamless integration of form and function. He glanced back and forth between Keelan and the armor, searching for any connections to the progenitor tech he was familiar with. "Can I take a closer look at some of the connections and panels?" Clive asked hesitantly, knowing how personal the armor was to the Gridlord. Keelan nodded, clearly putting great trust in Clive. "Of course." As Clive moved in closer, studying the various connections and wiring, he began to realize that some elements did feel familiar. The energy sources, the materials used in the armor's construction, and even some of the systems that functioned to make it a cohesive unit. It was clear that the technology had advanced considerably since his time, but at its core, there were aspects that stemmed from the progenitor tech he had known. While inspecting a section of the armor's back, Clive noticed an unfamiliar component. It appeared to be a small glowing crystal embedded within the suit. He asked Keelan, "Can you tell me about this crystal? Its function is unknown to me." Keelan looked down at his armor, his face betraying a hint of unease. That's the Oracle's eye, he explained. It's what allows the Grid Lords to communicate directly with the Oracle, and it's the source of each suit's unique abilities. It's considered sacred, and to be completely honest, even we Grid Lords don't fully understand its workings. Clive couldn't help but express his amazement as he continued to inspect the armor. The technology used here is truly impressive. It reminds me of liquid metal in some areas, seamlessly shifting and adapting. Keelan replied, Thank you. It's an honor to wear it, but it also carries a great responsibility. As Clive continued his examination, he politely asked, May I see your helmet? Perhaps hold it for a moment? Keelan hesitated, clearly uncomfortable, but handed the helmet over to Clive nonetheless. As Clive held the helmet in his hands, he noticed that it was a single, unbroken piece, save for the speaker, visor gaps, and other sensory apparatus. I couldn't help but notice when you took the helmet off, Clive remarked. It seemed to deform and unfold itself, fitting your face like a second skin. How is that possible, considering there are no visible joints or seams? Keelan responded with a light-hearted chuckle. Well, I'm a warrior, not a priest. My understanding of the armor's inner workings is limited. Clive tentatively reached out to touch Keelan's arm, looking for permission from the Grid Lord with his questioning eyes. Keelan nodded, allowing Clive to examine further. The armor felt like metal, but it wasn't cold to the touch. Armored plates were thick and solid, while the joints were thin and more like skin. Curious, Clive asked, How do you put the whole suit on? I don't see any seams or joints that would open. Keelan focused for a moment, and a seam suddenly appeared in the chest, parting slightly to reveal his bare flesh underneath. Clive stared, astounded. He whispered, to himself more than Keelan, More than 100 years of technology advanced after I disappeared, even before this fall. Could this suit be made of nanobots, working together to form a cohesive unit? Keelan, not understanding Clive's musings, concentrated again and willed the suit to close seamlessly. As the time passed, the two continued their conversation. Clive, the confused and baffled technician, and Keelan, the surprisingly pleasant and self-deprecating super soldier. However, unbeknownst to them, eyes watched from the shadows, analyzing their every move, and dark plans began to take shape. Chapter 12, Caius Hammerfist treaded silently to the edge of the dense tree line, the thick foliage soon giving way to a small rise overlooking a massive factory below. From this vantage point, the structure seemed to sprawl endlessly in every direction, its rugged architecture marked by futuristic but functional design. The low hum of the factory's machinery droned in the air, a constant reminder that this place was focused on efficiency, power, and dominance. To one side, close enough to offer Hammerfist support, but far enough to savor the experience of the forest, Thorn Jaxwolf stood enchanted by his surroundings. Though their armored suits remained battle-ready, the advanced technology within them amplified every touch, sound, and scent, allowing Thorn to indulge in the soothing, untamed embrace of the wilderness. Thorn closed his eyes for a few moments to lose himself to the sensations completely. The crisp scents of foliage and dew, the earthy aroma of damp soil, and the distant murmurs of wildlife busily awaiting the night. The whispering breeze rustled the leaves overhead, creating an almost otherworldly symphony. Meanwhile, Hammerfist studied the factory with keen eyes, his experienced gaze taking in every detail. Logistical routes snaked across the complex, workers scurrying like ants among the shifting shadows. The machinery itself hummed to life with virtually inaudible whirs and hissing steam, a testament to the fine art of the artificers who had designed and built them. Beautiful, Thorn murmured, his own attention briefly torn away from the forest to join Hammerfist in studying the factory. His tone was one of reluctant admiration, as though he couldn't help but respect the strength and innovation the factory represented, despite its harsh disruption to the natural world. Indeed, Hammerfist agreed, his voice as gritty and metallic as ever, yet inflected with a quiet sense of awe. This is a monument to human ingenuity, Thorn. With such might and potential, we can shape our destiny in ways never before imagined. Thorn tugged at a handful of leaves, rolling them in his armored fingers and marveling at the contrast between the factory's raw power and the forest's delicate vitality. The world would be a poorer place without such wonders. Hammerfist turned to Thorn, his wise eyes set beneath the familiar visage of his gladiator helm, and there was a hard edge to his words. He couldn't tell if Thorne was referencing their factory below or the nature around them. A few paces away from Hammerfist and Thorne, the imposing figures of Brightforge and Arkstone stood, clad in their signature orange and black armor, a stark contrast to the black and gold that adorned Thorne and Hammerfist. They had all been standing together, transfixed by the factory below, silent for some time. Eventually, Hammerfist broke the lull in the conversation. "So you take a stand against the Empire. A bold move, to be sure. The winner will enjoy the spoils, but the consequences of losing would be far more devastating than any potential gains." Ever confident, Brightforge met Hammerfist's words with a steady tone. "We won't lose." Hammerfist couldn't help but smile behind his visor, acknowledging the determination in Brightforge's voice. He was well aware of the long-standing rivalry between their cities, Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. They were so close together that their forces often clashed during the campaign season, creating a fierce enmity. For years, Cincinnati had remained a player on the field only through the support of the Empire. However, in recent decades, as the Empire's influence waned, Cincinnati managed to rebuild. The arrival of prominent gridlords like Brightforge had undoubtedly played a major role in shifting the balance. Hammerfist and Brightforge's paths had crossed many times on the battlefield, their shield and sword trading blows and sparks as they sought victory over one another. In recent years, Hammerfist had found himself retreating more often than vanquishing, but that did nothing to diminish the respect that had grown between them through countless confrontations. As the four gridlords stood there, the history of their battles hung heavily in the air, a mixture of both enmity and admiration. Hammerfist's voice rang strong and clear as he continued the conversation. "For too long, we have been an isolated island of freedom in a sea of the Empire's control. It's encouraging to witness their grip weaken, and I relish the idea of your success." Beside him, Thorne stared at the Cincy sword with a palpable hunger, his warrior instincts longing for the thrill of battle. He couldn't deny the prospect of a strong ally, however, and voiced his agreement with Hammerfist. "You know I want to cut at you, Brightforge. It's been too long since I last had a chance. But the idea of the Empire weakening, of having a real chance to bring some hurt to them, that would be something." Brightforge gestured toward the sprawling factory below. "Perhaps it's time for us to establish a direct trade agreement, then. We have a need to equip a large force with power weapons, but they are so scarce. Pittsburgh, with its foundries dating back to the before, is fortunate to possess the resources we seek. We are prepared to pay a handsome price." Thorne and Hammerfist exchanged a glance, recognizing the potential advantages that such an alliance could offer. With the Empire's power dwindling, the time was ripe for forging new bonds and bolstering their strength in numbers. Though the prospect of fewer battles against their long-standing rivals left both men feeling a pang of something akin to loss, they knew that the changing landscape of their world demanded new strategies. Joining forces with Cincinnati would undoubtedly create a formidable challenge for the Empire's aspirations, and perhaps even turn the tide in favor of those yearning to break free from their oppressive rule. Hammerfist put up a cautionary hand as he replied, "First of all, let's be clear. I have no authority to commit to anything. I am here to speak, but the final decision must wait for the Purdue, choosing to appoint the Rust Knight as our sword. Only then can any agreement be entered into." He paused, gathering his thoughts before continuing. "Secondly, I am reluctant to put weapons in the hands of your soldiers, knowing full well that our own people may be on the receiving end of their blows during the campaign season." Brightforge was candid in his response. "I can't promise that won't happen. Campaigning is what it is, and our forces must be ready. However, the flows we give in return could bolster your own troops in countless different ways. Keep in mind that every weapon we receive would also be raised against the Empire." Hammerfist narrowed his eyes, considering the possible outcomes. "Aye, a nice thought, but the Empire is retreating on its own. There's discord in New York, and even Detroit has been talking of revolt. So many variables at play." This revelation surprised Brightforge, who admitted, "I hadn't heard about Detroit. Rumors, perhaps?" Hammerfist shared the intel he possessed. The Gridlords in Detroit have been gaining renown, and the might of the city is growing. They still have a long way to go, but with the Empire keeping a wary eye on New York, and now actively warring with Cincinnati, Detroit might see an opportunity. Many of their vassals may seek freedom or renegotiate agreements, and client cities further afield from the Empire's reach could do the same. The whole world is watching Cincinnati right now. Brightforge, always searching for an angle, probed further. And what of Pittsburgh? You've maintained an uneasy truce with the Empire. Is it time to push back? Chapter 13. The garden offered Clive a stark contrast to the life he once knew. It was set away from the city's hustle and bustle, allowing the symphony of natural sounds to reach his ears clearly. The gentle rustle of leaves as a soft breeze wafted through the trees brought a melody of serenity, harmony, and peace. The soothing chirp of birdsong, the faint buzzing of bees busy with their daily tasks, and the sporadic, cheerful splashes of the fish seemed to weave together an orchestra dedicated to the celebration of life. These simple and tranquil sounds had been lost to him in his old life, but now they enveloped him with a sense of calm and groundedness he had rarely experienced before. As for the smells that graced his nostrils, the garden was an exquisite tapestry of fragrances. The lush scents of the soil, earthy and rich, mingled with the tantalizing aroma of various flowering plants and blossoms. Sweet, floral tones, some delicately subtle and others more heady, drifted through the air on the wings of the breeze. Every breath Clive took was layered with a complexity that his old life had seldom appreciated or even known. Clive's thoughts wandered to the future, pondering how he could secure his place and prove his usefulness in Denver. He desperately needed to demonstrate his worth to Jarway and show that he had valuable skills or knowledge that could earn his keep. There were expectations on him to provide insight into technology from the before, a daunting task, considering that he predated much of that technology by 100 years. Yet hope still flickered within him. Clive believed his fundamental understanding of order fields and computing might just prove beneficial to those around him. He hoped that despite the time difference, the principles and groundwork for the technology of the before would still endure. In the meantime, while he waited for Keelan, Clive decided he would soak up every detail of this unique and captivating world. He paid close attention to the people, customs, culture, and even the flora and fauna. All of these newly encountered and carefully observed aspects of life would eventually become just as important as his pre-existing skills, and ultimately would be the tools he'd use to build a stable, secure life in this strange yet beautiful new home. Suddenly, Clive noticed a strange man standing alongside him. The man was dressed in a cloak, with an odd combination of armor visible beneath it. Chainmail intermingled with Kevlar and armor plates, similar to those of a Gridlord, protected his body. The man was armed with an array of weapons, a steel katana sword, a glowing high-tech axe, and an assortment of three pistols that seemed to span from the 18th to the 22nd century. The first pistol appeared to be a classic flintlock, its wooden grip and brass fittings giving off an air of history and elegance. The second pistol seemed to be from the 20th century, a semi-automatic with smooth curves and a matte black finish. The final pistol was unlike anything Clive had ever seen before, with a sleek, ultra-modern design and a surface that seemed to shimmer and change colors as it caught the light. The man's cool, serene expression hinted at confidence and authority. His handsome face bore a faint smile, as if he knew something Clive didn't. Intrigued by this enigmatic figure, Clive couldn't help but wonder who he was and what his intentions might be. Hello, Clive stammered, caught off guard by the man's sudden appearance. I didn't see you there. The man's voice was calm and tinged with dry humor. I wasn't here. I just stopped by. Clive glanced up and down the empty pathway, puzzled by the fact that he hadn't noticed anyone approaching. My mind must have been elsewhere, he admitted. I didn't notice your approach. The stranger offered a reassuring smile. Don't worry, Clive. I prefer not to be noticed. Clive furrowed his brow, questioning how the man knew his name, but quickly trailed off as a thought struck him. How do you know my... He realized that many people in this world must know the name of the man who had come from the before. The man seemed to read Clive's thoughts and replied, "Your reputation precedes you. The whole town speaks of the man who came from the before, the very day the prophet disappeared. Your legend is already spreading to villages, hamlets, and soon all the cities will know your story. Many will come to see you, just as I have." Taken aback, Clive stammered, "You came to see me? I'm not worth the effort, really. I'm just a humble man, lost in time with nothing to offer. It's not worth the trouble." The man's smile never faded as he responded, just as dryly, "I'm not so sure about that. Time will tell, but I have a feeling you may prove to be tremendously worth it." Curious, Clive inquired, "Where do you come from?" The enigmatic man merely replied, "Nowhere in particular. I'm a traveler, a messenger." "Like a postman," Clive ventured, attempting to understand the man's position. The stranger shook his head. "Not quite. I'm a messenger with a single master. I speak for the Blood Knight." Clive's eyes widened slightly, some vague awareness of the Blood Knight flickering in his mind. He hesitated, unsure whether to place the figure among the many others that had crossed his path. Finally, he asked, "The Sword of the Boston Empire? The one who disappeared and left the Empire to fend for itself?" The man nodded knowingly. "Yes, disappeared is the right word. But the Blood Knight hasn't truly left. He's simply working towards his own purposes. And you're his messenger, bringing word to the tower on his behalf?" Clive probed further. The man leaned in and extended a hand. Clive shook it, noticing that while the stranger's grip wasn't overly forceful, there was undeniable power in the man's hands. "My name is Trident," the man said, "and the message I bring is for you, not the others in the tower. I don't believe I'm welcome in the tower." Clive's eyes darted around, searching for guards and feeling a small twinge of apprehension. "You're here illicitly?" he asked hesitantly. Trident gave a slight, almost dismissive bobble of his head. "Not explicitly disallowed," he replied, his tone carefree. "Don't worry. There's no danger to you or to me." "But the guards," Clive began, concerned for their safety. Trident waved off his worry. "I'm not concerned about the guards." Clive shifted uncomfortably. "I'm supposed to be meeting a Gridlord, the Arrow, Keelan Heath guard. He could be here any time." The enigmatic messenger merely smiled. "Don't worry about Keelan either. I certainly won't." Clive's unease was palpable, his breaths coming a little faster and his muscles unconsciously tensing. He looked around uneasily, worrying about who might be watching this potentially dangerous interaction. Trident seemed to sense his apprehension and asked, "You've been here a few days. Are you growing more comfortable with your surroundings, accepting this reality?" Clive was taken aback by the question, as no one had directly addressed his adjustment to this world so far. He hesitated for a moment before answering honestly, "I'm still not certain. It feels like I can't quite believe it. The first couple of days felt like I was hallucinating, and in a way, it still does. But I'm gradually growing more used to the idea. It's just hard to fathom a whole different reality." His apprehension bubbled beneath the surface, the knowledge that he was interacting with Trident. Someone who was potentially breaking rules and stirring up trouble left Clive feeling tenuous and uncertain of his own position. Trident nodded thoughtfully before saying, "So you think this situation is related to the order field you were working on? Do you have any ideas on how it might have propelled you here?" Clive explained, growing more animated as he delved into his research. "In my time, while working on these fields, I observed that at high intensities, they distorted time in a non-linear fashion, slowing it down, perhaps even stopping it in certain cases. But beyond a specific threshold, we weren't able to observe any noticeable effects on time." Clive was hit for a moment by the realization that the man knew he had been working on an order field before he blinked into this strange world. How could he know such a thing? Who had he told apart from Jarway? Trident, appearing knowledgeable and deeply interested, added, "Foot fields operate on a similar principle. The prophet they speak of was composed of a stable order field of great intensity that, we believe, suspended you in time. It wasn't so much time travel as it was a near-perfect stasis. What remains a mystery is what caused the field to collapse." He paused, adjusting his cloak slightly before continuing, "The interesting part is that the field's collapse seemed to be instantaneous. A partial collapse could have had disastrous consequences, parts of you suddenly aging, biological functions suddenly resuming without oxygen, and many other possible ill effects. You're very fortunate to be here now, seemingly unharmed. Clive, startled by the man's technical knowledge, the majority of the people here treated Bum, before tech like magic, hesitated and then stammered, "We? Who are we? How do you know all this?" Trident simply replied, "We are a group of people who, like the Blood Knight, have a deeper understanding of the grid and its associated properties. We want to expand our knowledge and connect with others who share our goals." Before Clive could respond, he noticed that Trident seemed to pause suddenly, his expression shifting as if he were listening intently to something unheard. Trident then stood up in a calm, unhurried manner and announced, "Your friend is coming. I should make my exit." "What about the message? You said you were here to bring me a message," Clive managed to ask before Trident slipped away. Trident paused and said, "Not much for now, but we will talk again soon." "The Blood Knight wants to send you a warning. You are unique and special. You may be able to extract usage from the towers and other devices in ways that the priests can't, or perhaps match their prowess without their difficult alignments and pressures from political forces. People like Jarway and those in Denver will seek to use you to upset the balance of power. In a world where each city is almost indestructible and insurmountable due to the tower fortress at its heart, it's difficult for power to be exerted beyond the borders of each domain. Jarway may pretend to be your friend, just like others who will come to you with words similar to mine. But know this, all of them seek to use you. The Blood Knight is no different, a determined man famed for cold calculation and callous action, but you may find his goals and treatment align better with yours." Clive, overwhelmed by the weight of Trident's words, couldn't muster a response. Trident glanced into the distance, and Clive followed his gaze to see Keelan emerging from a hedge-lined path. He looked back, only to find that Trident had simply vanished. As Keelan approached, Clive tried to process what had just transpired, feeling burdened by this foreboding warning. A chill ran through Clive's stomach as the prospect of terrible intrigue settled in, just as he was beginning to become accustomed to the idea of being in this strange new land. He looked at Keelan as he approached with a forced smile, trying to hide his disquiet. As his gaze flicked to where Trident had once stood, he found that the man had vanished. Trying to regain his composure, Clive observed Keelan at a distance. He had his helmet tucked under his arm, and his other hand was being held in an intimate manner by a strapping, muscular man. The two were speaking in hushed tones, their expressions suggesting intimacy and familiarity. They seemed jovial, happy, and were occasionally sharing bursts of laughter as they conversed. Keelan's eyes met Clive's, and he flashed him a bright smile as he bid his companion farewell. The intimate goodbye and deep smile exchanged between the two only further affirmed their close bond. Then, Keelan approached Clive with a hint of sheepishness in his grin. "Apologies once again for my tardiness," Keelan said with a lighthearted chuckle. "I got waylaid." Clive, still feeling uneasy from his encounter with Trident, tried to focus on the present moment. He found this apparent openness regarding homosexuality rather peculiar in this medieval-styled world he occupied, where he would have thought such things would have been a taboo. "Is that a special friend of yours?" Clive asked cautiously. Keelan answered unabashedly, "Yes, that's my lover, Sterling. I just lost track of time with our conversation." Keelan's expression softened, taking on a dreamy quality as if lost in thought. Feeling a sense of trust and comfort with Keelan, Clive decided to explore the subject further, hoping it wouldn't come across as overstepping. "I hope you don't mind me asking, but is it accepted here? Two men being together like that?" Keelan looked genuinely confused by Clive's question. "What do you mean accepted? Of course, Sterling and I are both men, but I don't understand your concern." Clive elaborated, "Where I come from, or at least in the past from my time, two men together was somewhat taboo. It wasn't something that was appreciated by everyone, and in history it was often kept secretive or even forbidden." Keelan's expression of utter perplexity was evident. "That's madness. Why would two men being attracted to each other, or even being in love, be forbidden? I can't believe such a thing. You must be joking, right? What possible reason could there be for such a prohibition?" Love is love. What reason under the sky would there be for two men to be prohibited from being together? Clive, growing nervous, tried to explain further. In my time, various religious institutions and churches frowned upon it. It was even illegal in some places, and punishable by law. Keelan looked both amused and confused by Clive's response. Why would a church concern itself with that? They should focus on their business of understanding the grid and guiding people in their faith. I still can't believe it. Such a silly idea, banning specific kinds of love. Love transcends everything, doesn't it? It shouldn't matter who it's between. And what an odd idea to draw lines around love based on gender. You are a curious fellow, Clive. You truly amuse me. Clive, amused by Keelan's genuine lack of understanding, decided to change the subject. Never mind, forget I brought it up. It just defied my expectations to see the two of you enjoying each other's company so freely. But it's good to see love isn't restricted here. Keelan chuckled, still a bit confused by Clive's preoccupation, but he let it pass. I can't imagine what that would be like, the strange specifics of those times you speak of. The very notion that some felt the need to restrict love seems humorous, indeed. As Keelan settled down, Clive found his mind returning to his conversation with Trident. He felt the need to know more about the powerful figure that had cautioned him. Keelan, Clive asked, Tiberius, the sword from the Boston Empire, I've heard him being referred to as the Blood Prince or Blood Knight. Can you tell me the distinction or what lies behind those titles? Settling into greater comfort, Keelan placed his helmet on the table and explained, When Tiberius was the sword of the Empire, he was known as the Blood Prince. The honorific was earned through his numerous victories and the slaying of many enemies. However, when he left that position, put down the sword, stopped belonging to the Tower and the Empire, he was no longer a prince and instead became a knight. Royal honorifics are granted only to the rarest and greatest swords through the eras. The sword in Kansas, Peregrine Stormblade, has been a revelation since he was chosen. He may well be on the verge of founding a new empire, one that might compete with, or even overcome, the Bostonian Empire. Peregrine has started to be known as the Red King in recent years, and will probably retain that title as long as he serves the Tower in Kansas. Clive nodded thoughtfully, piecing together this strange new world's traditions. I see. So when a gridlord steps down from their position, they gain the title of knight, Keelan clarified. Not exactly. Most gridlords amass considerable wealth during their tenure, as they gain a portion of the flows they earn for their tower. Over time, individuals like Tiberius accumulate so many flows that become vastly wealthy. With this wealth, they can afford to purchase very rare and powerful artifacts. Artifacts that can function in a manner similar to a suit, affecting order and entropy, as well as channeling other, more enigmatic magics that are difficult to understand or master fully. While a man equipped with such artifacts may pale in comparison to a gridlord, they undoubtedly represent a superhuman entity in the eyes of ordinary people. Capable of remarkable feats which far transcend the norm, a person wielding such powerful artifacts is known as a knight. Clive, intrigued, asked, Are there any such artifacts in Denver? Keelan replied, There are precious few, but some do exist. They are well guarded in the treasury, and on the rarest of occasions, granted to soldiers for special circumstances or missions. The idea sparked Clive's curiosity. I wonder if I could see one, maybe even interact with one. I might learn something valuable. Keelan laughed. If anyone else said such a thing, I would tell them it's impossible. But knowing how eager Jarway is to explore your knowledge and capabilities, he might just indulge you and allow it. You never know. Stranger things have happened since you arrived here. Chapter 14. Nicholas strolled through the streets of Denver at dusk, the fading sunlight casting shadows on the familiar architecture of steel, concrete, and plastic buildings. The mixture of old and new on both the structures and the people was evident in the way they dressed. A woman walked by wearing a medieval-style bodice with a modern denim skirt, while down the street a businessman rushed past in what might be recognized as a bastardization of a modern suit, yet sporting a pair of knee-high riding boots. The smells of hot oil frying battered foods filled the air as the sounds of electronic music spilled from shops lining the street. Nicholas couldn't help but admire the sights and sounds, the bustle and life, as he continued his walk. A horse and cart could be seen dragging a wagon of barrels of ale from a further sector, sharing the road with couriers on electric scooters, zipping past each other. Electric lights illuminated the taverns, their glowing screens a constant reminder of the ever-present technology the first sector enjoyed. As Nicholas walked, he mulled over the events of the past few days. It seemed unthinkable, an army of 3,000 unsuited men having a lasting impact on battles between mighty gridlords. Yet there they had been, their sheer numbers and bravery a deciding factor in the clash between the Cincinnati and Cleveland suits. The victory was theirs, and soon Ebb's as reward. As Nicholas passed through the gates into the next sector, he noted the change in scenery. Guards armed with auto rifles offered him respectful salutes, while the streets turned from blacktop to cobbled stones. The bright electric lamps were replaced with flickering oil lamps, casting a warm, inviting glow. The smells shifted too, from fried foods to the comforting scent of baking bread and the slight tang of burning oil. The people in this sector were still relatively comfortable, but visibly poorer compared to those in the first sector. Their clothes were older, simpler, and clearly made with less industry-dependent materials. Despite the difference in wealth, the atmosphere was no less lively. Electric music from the first sector was replaced by the melodic tunes of bands playing in taverns, their notes and laughter spilling out into the night air. Through the paved streets and warm lamplight, Nicholas continued his walk, taking in the sights and sounds that surrounded him, and perhaps finding a sense of camaraderie in the shared experience of life in a city of contrasts. Nicholas continued walking, finding the rhythmic sound of his footsteps to be a perfect accompaniment for deep thought. His mind drifted back to the offer Brightforge had made, converting the third into a specialist division, outfitting them with rare power weapons and the talents to face gridlords in combat. Their mission would be to win flows, and even with only a small portion of each victory allotted to him, it would be enough to make Nicholas a wealthy man in short order. The prospect of such wealth and prestige was certainly alluring. Beyond the riches, there would be many honors to be had, perhaps even a noble title, lands to call his own, and a legacy to leave behind. It was a daring, almost unimaginable idea, yet the thought of it sent a thrill of excitement through him. However, Nicholas couldn't help but feel a sense of trepidation deep within. The weight of the responsibility and the ultimate implications of such a division, created solely for the purpose of facing gridlords, were not to be taken lightly. To commit to this path would irrevocably change not only his life, but the lives of those who would serve beside him in the third. And with great power comes great risks, enemies, and challenges. As he strolled through the dimly lit streets, Nicholas wrestled with the decision before him, weighing the potential rewards against the cost, and grappling with the question haunting every potential leader. Could he, and should he, accept such a momentous task? As dusk deepened into night, Nicholas reached the next gate leading to the third sector. This area represented the sprawling majority of the city, where power lines were nearly non-existent and oil lamps were a rare sight. Much of the sector lay unlit, and what light could be found emanated from doorways and the occasional tavern. This was a residential area where people could not afford many luxuries, and some would save their earnings to experience a night in the second sector, or even the first, if a well-paying job allowed it. Nicholas wound his way down narrow side streets, many of which were unpaved, their surfaces merely packed dirt. He navigated the dimly lit paths with practiced ease, his eyes adjusting to the darkness. Eventually, he arrived at the door he sought, its windows warmly illuminated by the flickering glow of firelight, candles, and a small oil lamp. Pausing for a moment, Nicholas took a deep breath, steadying himself before raising his hand and knocking firmly on the door. As he stood waiting for a response, the muffled sounds of laughter and conversation from within trickled out to meet him, a reminder of the life, hopes, and dreams that existed behind even the most unassuming of doors in this sprawling city. The delighted face of an older woman, a testament to a hard life, greeted Nicholas at the open door. His mother. "My son, it's so good to see you," she exclaimed, her eyes brimming with concern. It's been far too long since you've visited. How are you holding up out there in the army? Nicholas reassured her, saying, I'm doing well, Mother. There's no need to worry. I've been working closely with Brightforge, and we've accomplished a lot. As he entered, his younger brother, Chris, a strapping lad in his late teens, nearly a man, rushed up to him. The stories have been spreading all through the neighborhood. They say you captured a wild orb and fought alongside Brightforge himself. They even say you saved his life and battled the Cleveland suits. Nicholas laughed and shook his head, trying to downplay the rumors. There are always legs on such tales, Chris. While I did play a part in capturing the orb, and Brightforge certainly appreciated my help, there was no life-saving involved. We fought together, and that's enough. Chris's eyes widened. But how many flows did you get for capturing the wild orb? I heard there's a huge bounty on it. Nicholas replied, I don't know exactly yet, but it's not flows we'll be getting, it's ebbs. Most of it goes to the city, gridlords get a very small share, and the troop gets even less. But when I get paid, I'll treat you to a night in the first sector. Chris's face lit up, ecstatic. Really? A night in the first sector? Can we see a movie? It's been years. And maybe play some electric games? And try that better beer they serve? Nicholas chuckled. Yes, we can see a movie and play some games, but don't get too carried away. Remember, it's only ebbs, not flows. There are other places to spend what little we'll get, like right here at home. Chris guffawed. No matter where we spend it, it's still a treat. Chris returned to his bowl of stew at the table. Nicholas, meanwhile, continued to the fireplace, where his father sat, an old man with a long beard, both of his legs ending at the knees. Nicholas's father was known as Old Nicholas by most, as Nicholas had become so well known and highly regarded. Nicholas sat down alongside his father, hands clasped in front of him, warmth emanating from the fire. Old Nicholas looked at him with sincerity in his eyes, saying, Heard about your success, son. Well done. The city needs the likes of you, and I'm very proud of what you're doing. Nicholas responded, his tone somewhat dismissive. I'm only doing my job, father. I'm just trying to help the family. Old Nicholas slapped his leg nubs and laughed heartily. Well, this family could use plenty of help. I'm not much good anymore. Nicholas sighed. You did your part, father. I'm sick of reminding you. You brought honor and wealth to our family. The city should be doing far more to pension soldiers wounded while serving. Old Nicholas nodded in agreement, but then switched gears, asking, So what brings you here, son? I wasn't expecting to see you tonight. Nicholas hesitated for a moment, then spoke up. I came because I wanted your advice. His father leaned back in his chair and raised an eyebrow, clearly intrigued. I'm listening. Gathering his thoughts, Nicholas began, Brightforge has made an offer, a proposal to equip the Third with power weapons, inject talent, and ultimately make us an elite force capable of combating gridlords. We'd win flows in this process and get a tiny portion of each. It wouldn't take long before we become wealthy men, with many honors, maybe even a title and some lands. Old Nicholas listened intently, his face a mixture of curiosity and apprehension. After a few moments of thought, he finally offered his opinion. It's a rare opportunity, my son, but you must weigh the rewards against the risks. You've already made us proud, and we are grateful for all you've done for this family. Becoming involved in such a venture might bring great wealth and honors, but the dangers and sacrifices that come with it cannot be ignored. Nicholas nodded, understanding the wisdom in his father's words. I know, but it's tempting. Brightforge believes in me, and we could make a real difference in this city. Wealth and power are not guaranteed, but if there's any chance of improving our lives and supporting the city, shouldn't I take it? Old Nicholas sighed, placing a hand on his son's shoulder. I always knew you were destined for great things, and your courage and dedication make me proud. We raised you with strong values, and I trust your judgment. But never forget the lessons I taught you as a boy, and remember that the path of honor and duty, though difficult, is always the right one to follow. Nicholas looked into the somber eyes of his father and embraced him. I won't forget your wisdom, father, I promise. Old Nicholas, deep in thought, responded softly. It's a great opportunity with a promising future, no doubt. You could gain much wealth and put our family back on track, but there are terrible risks involved. You'd be spending more time near the Gridlords and facing a greater chance of actually fighting them. His gaze dropped to his severed legs, and he continued, Gridlords are serious business. I only have my life today, even if I do not have toes to stand on. He laughed, a twisted sense of humor evident in his voice. Nicholas leaned in close and looked his father directly in the eyes. I've been thinking that it may be for the best. With the pressure to bring honor, wealth, and glory, I fear that Chris may decide to enter the choosing, follow in your footsteps, and I can't bear the thought of him suffering the same fate as you. Old Nicholas took a deep breath, considering his son's words. Old Nicholas shook his head in disagreement. There's a long tradition of choosing Gridlords in our family. I would be honored if Chris goes for the choosing when his time is right. If he is chosen, he could save our family, but he's too young yet, and I understand your fear that he may be too impetuous. Nicholas nodded slowly before saying, But you were disappointed that I never went for the choosing. Old Nicholas admitted, I never understood why you didn't. I only wore the suit for 2 years, but during that time I had my glories and wealth, which kept our family going for a long time before it ran out. Don't get me wrong, I'm proud of you, but you shouldn't fear my fate. You could have been better, and one day, Chris might even become a great Gridlord. But hopefully not for some years. He continued, Go to Brightforge and tell him you agree to his proposal. Do as he asks. The wealth you gather, the glories you earn, they will keep us comfortable, elevate us, until the day Chris is ready to make the decision for himself. Nicholas paused for a moment, taking in his father's advice. He had expected no less. He wondered how his thinking might change when news of the coming war reached him.
New episodes every Friday, with newer episodes always waiting for Gridlords on Patreon.